From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hi, Ann. Is it fall? Is it autumn?
It feels like it. It's a cold day
yet.
In New York City. Technically, isn't it the 21st? September 21st is the end of summer.
Yeah. And the sad thing about it is, other people have commented on this, COVID began, I think technically, we began the lockdown in winter.
Yeah.
And then we had spring, and then we had summer, and now we're about to have fall, and we're still not out of this thing. Not to be depressing.
Yeah. 6 months, right? We came back to the city yesterday, and I realized as I was walking in that it was just a little bit over 6 months ago that was the last day of my son's school.
And have you seen all the open seating, outside seating with all
yes,
the restaurants?
It's great.
It's actually quite nice.
I haven't sat in one, but it looks terrific.
I've been going in from time to time and having dinner or drinks. For people who are not from New York, there are entire lanes of road outside of and streets that are taken over by kind of nicely set up outside dining areas for restaurants so they can make ends meet. And it's the one thing that has made New York a little bit better.
Yeah, it's great. It's all over the city right now. And I hope it stays.
Can I note one more thing?
Yeah.
49 days till Election Day.
Wait, can I just ask you something?
Yeah.
I feel that your count, maybe I'm reading Twitter wrong, but you and Joe Biden seem to have a different day count.
We do?
I've been meaning to ask you this, yes.
Maybe go
someone
with Joe.
Can check while we're recording, but
well,
I was today, like the other day.
Today is Tuesday, said, September 15th, and it's 7 weeks. No, I misspoke last week on the program, and nobody knows I misspoke. Because that was edited out. I realized later that I had misspoken.
Okay. Well, the other day, I feel like I saw literally your tweet and a tweet by Joe Biden back to back, and you had
different
number of days. And I was like, is Preet talking about a different election? Or hopefully Joe Biden knows what day the election is. Like, but something's not right there. But by the way, it could have been me. But anyway, I'm glad we're all on the same page that we're talking about the presidential election November 3rd.
And debates coming up. We're going to be talking about debates soon. That'll be interesting.
Definitely.
Should we talk about some news since the last time you and I got together to do this thing we do?
Yeah.
So Nora Danahy, she's not a household name. Nora Danahy was the top deputy to John Durham, who is the U.S. attorney in Connecticut. And John Durham, some people may remember, has been tasked by the Attorney General of the United States to do an investigation of the investigation into Russia and all of that stuff that we've been talking about for the last couple of years. And what's interesting about it is Nora Danahy has been a longtime prosecutor. She overlapped with me when I was the U.S. attorney at SDNY. She was the acting U.S. attorney for a period of time in 2009 and in 2010 in Connecticut, known to be a sober, clear-eyed, full of integrity career prosecutor.
And she did the investigation around the firing of the U.S. attorneys, right, by Alberto Gonzalez. She's done a lot of political corruption work. I mean, she's very well regarded. I don't know her personally as you do, but she has a very strong reputation.
And she came back into government basically to work on this thing that John Durham was assigned, and then last week suddenly resigned. And there's a local newspaper article in the Hartford Courant. It's kind of nice when there's a local news scoop. Says that she resigned in part because of pressure she was feeling from the Justice Department, Bill Barr, I suppose, to issue some report or charges in connection with the Durham investigation before the election. Now, we should pause there for a second. I wonder what you think about this. That's not been confirmed. She didn't make any statement like some other people have when they stepped down. It's just reported that she has been telling colleagues for some weeks that she has been growing increasingly uncomfortable and has been thinking about resigning. So we should, I like to caveat these things saying, you know, maybe there's some other personal reason why she stepped down, but it is unusual at this late date to step down from the thing that you came back to do unless you have some qualms about it.
There's also been some reporting that there's been pressure to put out an interim report. So we've been spending a lot of time talking about the Department of Justice policy on not bringing criminal charges that could impact election within 60 days before an election or 90 days. We'll talk about that a little bit more probably, but depending on who you talk to. But generally, I think it's 60 days. So we're within that 60-day window. And it would be unlikely, or we should not see in the normal course of things, we should not see any charges coming out of this matter between now and election. The day after the election, no problem. But this is obviously, it's an investigation into the 2016 investigation of the Trump campaign. It's political. It will impact the election one way or another. And so you and I would expect not to see anything if normal rules were followed. So what's been reported is this idea that Barr wanted an interim report from Durham. And we should talk about this just for a second, because it's not normal to have reports in investigations. But Durham's investigation started a little bit strangely, right? Like, as you say, to investigate the investigators. And it wasn't ever clear if it would be criminal. It was more kind of done, in my view, at least initially, that it would be a report, would be the outcome. They did charge the one lawyer at the FBI. We talked about that recently, who had made a false statement in an email, Klein Smith. But this idea that there would be any report, interim or otherwise, prior to an election, if that were true, and again, we don't know the full facts, she has not spoken, that would be an extraordinary thing. And really just like, it's not what DOJ does. They never do interim reports, if they ever do reports, and they rarely do them, but they did do one in Ferguson. Obviously, Mueller did one. So it's not implausible to have a report, but the idea of doing like an interim, that would be completely—
Well, I think the whole idea of doing report is odd. The whole thing is odd. We talked about this back when the Durham investigation began, and I remember thinking and saying, I don't understand quite why you have a U.S. attorney doing this, because it wasn't clear it was a criminal investigation or a civil investigation, right, that would lead to an enforcement action, that kind of thing. Like, I never conducted any kind of review and was never assigned any kind of review like that in 7.5 years. You investigate to see if a crime was committed, or you investigate to see whether or not there was a civil infraction, and then you bring an action or you don't. And there is a body within the Justice Department that does this kind of thing, that issues reports on a regular basis. That's the mandate. It's called the Inspector General, right? And the Inspector General also has taken a look at the Russia investigation. So it seemed like an effort to get another bite at the apple. And I'm not sure, you know, why Durham accepted it. It did lead to this one charge with respect to Kleinsmith. Maybe there'll be others. But yeah, in the ordinary course, outside of the Civil Rights Division context, you mentioned Ferguson, you don't do reports. The idea of doing an interim report or any kind of report that may talk about bad conduct on the part of individuals without charging those individuals, that's exactly the thing the Trump administration at first claimed they fired Jim Comey for, right? There was an investigation of Hillary Clinton. No charge was brought. And then he went on and on about why she did all these bad things and mentioned those things in public. And that, many people have said, and you and I think agree, is a no-no.
And actually, I think that what Comey did opens the door to this in some ways, right? Because, you know, Comey did something that hasn't been done, right? You don't do this kind of action that could impact an election. And now he set a little bit of a precedent. I don't want to say that too strongly. It was widely condemned. And I think career lawyers, DOJ attorneys all thought it was, you know, overwhelmingly thought it wasn't the right thing to do. But it opened a door for Barr to argue, like, look, you know, this has been done before. This is what we do. Can we talk for one second about, like, I was thinking a little bit about the Danahy stuff and thinking, like, what do we know for sure and what don't we know? And so, you know, to me, like, here's what we know for sure. We know for sure that it felt like a sudden resignation, and it's certainly a resignation close in time, 50 days out to the election. And it feels to me like something triggered it, right? Again, we don't know exactly what. We do know that the president has taunted Barr. You know, he has that tweet saying, like, Bill Barr could go down in history as one of the greatest AGs if he does something, or he could be just like the others. Meaning bring charges in the Durham investigation or release a report. We know that she was very personally close to Durham. They worked together for years. They're trusted confidants. You talked about her reputation being strong. Some of the other things we know for sure, like, in my view, this crushes Durham. And I want to hear what you have to say about it. But I think it puts Durham in a very difficult position. If let's say it's true that they were moving toward issuing an interim report or bringing an indictment before the election, you know, it basically sort of, it just really compromises him. He's out there on his own, right? And it looks like it's political.
So what we also know is John Durham and Nora Danahy are personally and professionally close. And look, I got to tell you, when you work on something like this, and she's so important and maybe was overseeing the day-to-day operations of the investigation, as an initial matter, just losing that, you know, important person affects the investigation. There no doubt other people working on it. It affects their morale. And then John Durham probably is wondering what he should say or do, right? I totally agree with you. Because Durham himself has a good reputation. We'll see if that lasts, depending on what he does and whether he bows to pressure.
You know, I was going to ask you about this. So everybody says he has a good reputation. I don't know him, and I'm not doubting his ability as a prosecutor. But there's a question in my mind as to how strong he is, right? And I don't know if that's fair or not. But that seems to
people
be the
are revealed
of some of the thing. Yes,
we should pause on this, right? Is make a general statement. There are lots of people who have had good reputations. And then Trump comes along or Barr comes along and there's pressure brought to bear or there's influence that's brought to bear. And some people distinguish themselves and stand up to it and don't do the wrong thing and are independent and others go along. And so sometimes people can have relatively lengthy careers and have good reputations, but that's in part because maybe they haven't been tested in a particular way that this administration tests people. So that is certainly true. And it kind of reveals people. Do they want to cling to power? Do they want to stay in office? Do they want to do the right thing? What is the decision they're going to make? Nora Danahy, I think all the evidence points to that the fact that this was a resignation, at least in part, out of protest, but we don't know that yet for sure.
I think it's also important to note that the fact that she did political corruption cases as a federal prosecutor means that she will have, throughout her career, adhered to the DOJ policy, right? It's a practice. It's not formal in the way that some people might think it is. And you and I have talked about, should this be a law?
We should talk about that a little bit more, right? The 60-day rule.
Okay.
Some people, let's just be clear. People go on television and they say things about the 60-day rule. There is no statute, hard and fast regulation that says in no circumstances at all, can you bring any case that may have some effect on an election within 60 days of the election or 90 days of the election. That's not true. And cases have been brought that have been, you know, applauded within 90 days of the election. Two Republican congressmen were charged within 90 days of the 2018 election. Trump got mad about that because he thought it was going to hurt the Republicans in the House, not because he thought it was a violation of some rule. It is, however, a sort of prudential rule of discretion that prosecutors should take into account the proximity of an election and not do things that would unduly influence the election. It's a conversation that we've had in my office from time to time, and I'm sure in other offices. That doesn't mean that you, in no circumstances, can ever do it. But you have to consider what the political landscape is. And so it's not like Bill Barr seems to be pressuring John Durham to put out a report or make indictments or bring indictments close in time to an election. He looks like he understands what Donald Trump is going to do, right? Donald Trump has been hinting that he wants to use whatever Durham finds as a cudgel politically against Biden and against Obama, even though Obama's not on the ticket. And knowing that there is a political figure, and it's the President of the United States, no less, who is dying to use it for political purposes, should put a thumb on the scale to not rush it. I mean, again, it's one thing to say, look, the report is done, and should we delay it because there's an election around the corner? It seems to be worse than that. It seems to be that there's some time that they need to do to complete the investigation and do whatever report or bring whatever indictments they need to bring, if any, and that they're being rushed to do it before the election. For what purpose? For the purpose of influencing the election, because that's the signal that Donald Trump is sending. Whether or not there's a hard and fast 60-day rule, that seems wrong, immoral, unethical, and contrary to precedent.
I think that's exactly the right way to see it, which is that the practice has come up because it's considered to be unfair and to be unjust. And so that's why the practice has evolved. And it's exactly right. And the fact that it's a longstanding process and norm just reinforces that it exists for a reason, which is to stay out of politics. And we sort of all know the reason why now, because we've watched the president sort of attack institutions and really undercut the reputation and respect for institutions. And institutions matter, right? People only go forward to law enforcement if they have trust in law enforcement. And, you know, you want people to have a belief in the Department of Justice and its fairness, particularly in part because they do have to do political corruption cases. They have to do very sensitive cases. And you want to believe that the men and women who work there are following the law and the facts. And so that's why it's so important for the department to follow this type of practice. It's never been more important than it is now when the department is so under attack. It's like the president has doubled down in trying to use the department for his own political advantage. And Barr seems to be acquiescing to that and going along with it. And, you know, one of the things about Danahy is that it looks like she's not. right? And I think it's important to remember also that there were very, very well-respected prosecutors who resigned in the wake of the Michael Flynn. When Bill Barr changed course on Michael Flynn, there are prosecutors, Roger Stone, right? Like, so this is something that, you know, in my time at the Department of Justice, I can't think of anyone, and I was there under George W. Bush, I can't think of anyone who resigned in protest in the way we're seeing happen here. And whether Danahy says it explicitly or not, like, you know, she's been on this investigation for a year and a half. All of a sudden, she's stepping out essentially right before the election when everybody's been talking about Barr bringing an October surprise and Durham bringing an October surprise. So it just feels to me like the likelihood of this being a coincidence and it not being connected to the election is almost zero.
Can I ask you a question?
Always.
We keep talking about this issue of influence of the election as if that's preordained. But, you know, I have my doubts about that. Even if there is some report, even if it does say things, whether you agree with them or not, that are negative about the Russia probe, I have my doubts about whether or not it will actually move the needle on the election. I think most people's minds are made up. People have a view of the Russia investigation one way or the other. And so I don't know, not to dismiss the fact that this is an important issue and influencing the election shouldn't happen. But I don't know. Is it going to matter? Is it really going to matter? I don't think so.
I kind of agree with you. I think people expect, like, I sort of expect it almost now that the president is trying to use this. What I think is really going on, Preet, is that the president is obsessed with this issue. And, you know, every chance he gets, he tries to undercut the Mueller probe, the 2016 Russian hacking into the election. Like, everything about it is he's fighting hard to try to say that his election was legitimate. And so it feels to me like this is about the president and the president's ego. To your point earlier, the inspector general has already looked at it. I doubt there's much new that they're going to uncover. Even the guilty plea of the FBI lawyer, that was in the inspector general report. So I'll be really surprised if there's a lot new that we don't know that Durham could uncover. And again, I think most people will now either believe it because they're part of the president's base, or they'll discount it because they think it lacks credibility and has been done for political purpose. So I tend to agree with you. But, you know, at the same time, like, the whole point is that we shouldn't even, like, we won't know whether or not it influences the election, right? There's, like, no way ever to measure that exactly. I mean, they could poll on it, exit poll on that. But it then becomes a little bit of this question of, like, it's just wrong and it shouldn't be done and it shouldn't be a question. I know you're not saying this, but it shouldn't be a question of whether or not it's actually going to have a real impact. They just shouldn't do it.
No, absolutely. I'm just wondering, you know, there's a lot
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with you.
Will it affect the election? And we're only, as I said, 49 days out. I think there's going to be a lot of other things that influence the election, but I guess we'll have to see.
So, Preet, there's another issue that came up this past week, and the Department of Justice also relates to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice moved to intervene in the defamation case that's been brought by President Trump against Jean Carroll. And listeners may remember that Jean Carroll, she's formerly a contributor to Elle magazine, a writer. She stated that she'd been raped by Trump in the Bergdorf Goodman's dressing room 25 years ago. While she made this accusation a couple years back, Trump denied that while he was president and said that she was lying. Jean Carroll then went on to sue the president for defamation surrounding this. And so the president has been represented by his private attorneys. Now DOJ is moving to intervene. What was your reaction to that?
My reaction was the same as most legal experts, and I think the same as yours. It seems odd and weird and not the normal course. But that's before I look, you know, deeply at the law. The president of the United States did something years ago in his personal capacity, and there was an accusation with respect to that. And then as president, he made some remarks that I don't see how they can be considered part of his official duties as president. And that has to be the basis on which you get the DOJ at taxpayer expense to defend you. I mean, you and I have worked in government. Many, many people are sued. Criminal defendants sometimes file suit. Civil defendants sometimes file suit. And because you're doing things in the ordinary course of your official duties, in my office, the civil division would represent AUSAs who got sued and had to face litigation. There has to be a certification by someone in the department that, in fact, the conduct on which you're being sued happened in connection with your official duties. That certification was made here with respect to the president. It seems bizarre that these comments about conduct that happened years earlier as a private citizen could be deemed to be within the president's official duties. I have talked to two superstar former colleagues in the U.S. Attorney's Office in my civil division, you know, wondering, am I missing something? Their view, the view of both of them, was that this was not a sound argument.
That the president's making, that the Department of Justice is making.
That the president's making. I'll just point out one other parochial thing. This suit was unfolding in state Supreme Court in New York. And removal means it goes to federal court. And as you said, it's come to the Southern District of New York. In the ordinary course, during the 7.5 years that I was there, that lawsuit and that motion would be handled by some person in the SDNY, maybe alongside someone in Washington, but there would certainly be the U.S. Attorney's signature block on the motion, and a particular assistant U.S. attorney would be on the motion. There's no such signatory on this. That could mean that Washington decided they want to handle it on their own because they don't, you know, trust SDNY, and usually we would object to that. Or the acting U.S. attorney, Audrey Strauss, wants no part of this, either because it's overly political or because they don't think it's well-grounded in law and fact. It's got to be one of those two things. And that will be noticed by the judge in the case.
It feels to me like it is more likely to be the latter, that the acting U.S. attorney didn't join, in part because I think you're right. I think Southern would fight very hard to be a part of it. And also, DOJ should understand that the judge will note that the Southern District isn't part of it. It looks strange, right? It sort of raises an issue that you wouldn't want to raise, I think, in the normal course, unless there was a problem. So one of the other things just to note is that, you know, and this has been in state court. The state judge recently opened up the door for a potential deposition of the president related to this, and also said that the president may have to provide DNA because of a dress that Jean Carroll still has.
Didn't you think that dress and DNA and president would never have to be spoken in the same sentence ever again?
Again. Yeah, exactly. After Bill Clinton. Yes. Right. I very much hope that would be the case.
Look, history rhymes, as they say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's true.
Carry on.
No, I was having this moment when I read it and I was like thinking about all the work I did when I did sex crimes with DNA, and DNA stays on clothes for long periods of time.
I don't think it was a gap. This one was not a gap dress.
No, but the whole thing was going through my head as well, the sort of parallels. But yeah, so look, there's the question is sort of why is DOJ doing this now? I mean, in part it's because the state court was heating up, and really what I think it is that the president's defense lawyers have basically said, look, this is the best possible defense, which is to walk in and say that the Federal Tort Claims Act protects you and that you will be immune. And just to like go a little bit weedy on the law for a second, because my initial reaction was exactly the same as yours. This is 25 years ago. It relates to an incident that has nothing to do with the president's official duties. And essentially, the only thing that the president did was make a denial and a criticism of Ms. Carroll while he was in office. There are two things to look at. First is the tort law, and the second is a case that Bill Barr cites.
The case law is very clear, and there's a D.C. Circuit case called Ballinger on the topic that says that because we are a representative democracy, officials who are elected and answer press questions while they're in office, even if those questions relate to their personal activity and could bear upon their personal fitness, is in fact in the course of federal employment and can be therefore certified under the Westfall Act.
Ballinger related to a congressman who had made some statements about his wife didn't like living across the street from an organization that she'd likened to being similar to Hezbollah, which is the organization that's on the terrorist watch list. And so he sued for defamation, and this goes in front of the D.C. Circuit, which found that the congressman was immune and pointed to the restatement of agency, which is a law that defines the scope of an employee's conduct. The restatement says that basically points out two potential areas that could be defined as within the scope of employment that could apply in this matter, which is one, is the action the kind that the person is employed to perform? And the other is whether or not the action is actuated, at least in part, by a purpose to serve the master, right? Basically, like that, you know, you're doing it in the course of your employment to serve your boss. And so the question really here, you sort of shorthanded it, is this within the scope of the president's actions? What I think is complicated is that, and why I think that this isn't exactly as I would have expected to be, is that, you know, your sort of gut is that this is a private matter, relates to the president's conduct when he was not in office. But as to the defamation claim and the statement made by the president, it is clear that there are cases that have found, like, you know, Senator Kennedy was found immune when he had a conversation at one point about Operation Rescue, talking about anti-abortion activists. And so it's clear that, like, a politician's scope of office, like, they talk about a lot of things. And so there are definitely examples where there has been immunity that has been found. But I think here, I think the president may win this one, but I don't think he should. But it is, there's a legal argument the president can make. But the reason I don't think he should win is that it would basically be saying that anything in the world is within the president's domain and anything he talks about is part of his official job. I mean, it goes back to the president having this view of himself as this autocrat and the president being all powerful. Like, there'd be no line if this could apply to his private conduct.
Yeah, we should be sure that we're distinguishing two things. One is whether or not he deserves taxpayer-funded defense by the Justice Department. And separate from that is whether he deserves to prevail in the suit, whether he's immune or not. And those are two different questions, and they have different standards. With respect to the first question, that's the one on the table most directly at the moment. You and I were talking about this before we started taping. You know, often Bill Barr gets asked a question and he talks some smack, and he makes, you know, passing references to, you know, to facts that are not in the record. Here, you know, he was pretty strident and made specific reference to that case that you mentioned and to other, you know, areas of law. And you got the sense that he was a little bit more prepared to answer this question. And look, and they do have a certification from within the department saying this is within the scope of the president's duties, and you can argue about it. But, you know, as when we think about the arguments made by the Justice Department and by the president's allies and by the president himself, it is useful sometimes to put them on a spectrum. And sometimes the arguments are ludicrous and ridiculous. Sometimes they're arguable, and sometimes they're strong. That last bit is not often the case, but sometimes they are. There's another legal question that I don't know the answer to, but people have talked about it with respect to the question of whether or not the DOJ should be defending the president in what looks like a private suit. And that is, the Federal Tort Claims Act applies only to an employee of the government.
The case law is crystal clear that the Westfall Act applies to claims against the president, the vice president, as well as other federal employees and members of Congress.
Is the president an employee of the government? And I think that's a little bit of an unclear question, or the answer to that is a little bit unclear. The act defines employees as officers or employees or persons acting on behalf of a federal agency or members of the military. And, you know, one legal scholar, Leah Littman, has pointed out, it's not at all clear that the president is an employee. The president is the head of government. And if he's an employee, that implies that there's an employer. And who would that be?
Yeah, I think that's right. And just to sort of go back to the specifics of the merits, just to sort of say it this way, I think that there's an argument that the tort immunity statute, that the courts have had an expansive reading of the scope of what an elected official's office might be. But I think it's also really important to think about here, we're talking about a rape allegation against him personally. I think it's different if he were discussing a bill to outlaw rape, a victim's compensation bill. Like, obviously, he's going to be talking about this subject. But what's different is that this is about his personal conduct, and there's no potential argument that a sexual assault would fall within the scope of the presidency. And so I think that there's, like, a really interesting, you know, politicians have been given sort of wide berth on what statements can be considered part of their official capacity and what cannot be. But this feels to me like it is beyond the line, both potentially because the statute doesn't apply to the president. And as everybody knows, like, if the law doesn't say it applies to you, then the court either has to read it in that it would apply to the president, which it hasn't done before. This has never come up. Or they have to follow the letter of the law as it's written, which is what most courts, in my view, when a law is clear on something, most courts will follow the clear language of the law.
Yeah, we should make another point. You know, when you make arguments, whether you're a member of Congress or you're a company where you're the president of the United States, you'd like to think there's some consistency in the arguments you make to the courts, even if they're different contexts. You don't make arguments of convenience to avoid liability or responsibility, depending on what the circumstances are, and you argue different points of law. In other contexts, we've seen the Department of Justice advance one position in one case and a different position in another case, and that is happening here as well. Leah Littman, to cite to her again, points out that in this case, with respect to the defamation suit, the president wants to make the argument through the Department of Justice that his comments, even about a private matter, constitute official action, something that's officially part of the duties of the president of the United States as a supposed employee of the government. In another context that's been fought out in court as well, the president wanted to justify the ability to block people from following him on Twitter, right? And in that case, as Leah Littman writes, the department has argued that the president can block people on the social media site because the president's Twitter feed amounts to purely private speech, not official action. So if it's on Twitter and he likes it and he wants to evade liability for blocking people, it's private speech. On the other hand, if it's about an alleged rape from years before that he talks about and denies, that's official action. Those things are inconsistent. And by the way, courts notice things like that.
I agree. And it's also, it really does speak to the president's intent, what he's trying to do here. And I agree. It's important to look at how he flip-flops his position, really, in order to gain additional power for himself.
So, you know, we've been doing this long enough, Anne, that stories come back to us that we've talked about at some length previously. And one story that we both talked about is the voting situation in Florida. And I think we're both in agreement, though we were former prosecutors, that once you've served your time in a criminal context and you come out of prison and you re-enter society, in the same way that you are able to reassert all sorts of other rights, the right to vote should be reinstated. And Florida is one of those states that didn't allow it and was pretty draconian in removing the right to the franchise on the part of people who had been incarcerated. And in 2018, as we've discussed, there was a referendum on the ballot, and the people of Florida voted pretty overwhelmingly to restore the right to vote for people who have been incarcerated, presuming that they have finished their period of incarceration. That was undone, right, by Governor DeSantis, who essentially put through the legislature a law that basically took, you know, a lot of the thrust out of that constitutional amendment, saying, well, you still can't vote if it is the case that you owe any fines or penalties in connection with your sentence. And that finally went to court and was winding its way through court. And it's interesting that in this show, we've talked a lot about something that people have maybe not focused on as much, and it's kind of obscure in the law, the en banc sitting of a court. Well, in Florida, there's the 11th Circuit. We've talked about the 2nd Circuit, the D.C. Circuit. You had the entire 11th Circuit Court of Appeals considering this issue, whether that law was enforceable or not, or was it proper or not. And they decided something that I don't think we agree with, did they?
Yeah, I was surprised by the decision, although the 11th Circuit is fairly conservative. And so I think, you know, maybe it isn't a surprise, but the decision that the 11th Circuit came to is that Florida can require felons to pay all fines and fees before they can vote. And, you know, it's basically they found that it wasn't a due process clause violation. And so, and they also said you're not required to tell each felon what they owe and set up an easy system for them to know, basically.
That's the craziest part of the whole thing, right? Just as a practical matter,
totally.
One can make the argument, you know, we're talking about putting arguments on a spectrum. Look, I think it's not great, but you can make the argument. Look, if the point is that you pay your debt to society, that includes doing your incarceration time and also paying whatever fine or penalty that was assessed by the judge. I kind of get that. I think that there are reasons why you should give a buy on that. But it's crazy to say, not only do you have to pay your fines and penalties, but we don't have to tell you what they are because our system is all messed up. And by the way, if you guess wrong and you have a fine or a penalty that hasn't been paid and you show up to vote, that's a felony that's going to land you back in prison. That to me is insane.
Yes, and you're completely right. Just to sort of go to the legal crux of the 11th Circuit's argument also, what they basically said is that the fines and fees are part of the terms of sentence of an inmate. And, you know, we should also go back to the fact that Florida voted overwhelmingly in favor of this constitutional amendment, and this applies to 1.4 million Florida residents that fall under this and would be people who've been formerly convicted of felonies, and they would be eligible under this. What the 11th Circuit is saying, you have not completed your sentence until you paid your fines and fees. And that is, it's onerous. It is, the opponents of it have likened it to a poll tax, basically making people pay money to vote. And it really, I think, goes back to this underlying question of, you know, in my view, you know, the people of Florida have spoken on this issue, and the governor is now trying to basically obstruct people's ability to vote. Also, as you note on the practical question, like, if you expect people to be able to pay fines and fees, government has to be responsible to provide that information quickly and easily. And again, I don't favor fines and fees. I personally think that it's really important that systems, and we've seen this and we particularly see it in some particular states, where states have tried to pass off all the costs of criminal justice to people who are impacted. So for example, if you want to be out on release on a GPS device, you have to pay for that GPS device. And, you know, it's obvious that you could say, well, that makes sense. Why wouldn't you? And the short answer is it's very inequitable. A lot of people don't have access to the ability to do that. And then that determines who's in and who's out. And there is something, in my view, about making a system pay for itself to be very efficient and to run well, right? To basically make decisions about how do you prioritize things. And by the way, you know, a lot of people cannot pay fines and fees. And so again, like, I think the bigger point here is, I think this will go to the Supreme Court. I don't know that it gets there before the election. And so I think that Governor DeSantis will have won this round in Florida. And the question is, does it stick if it goes to the Supreme Court? Or is there another constitutional amendment? Or does the state of Florida do the right thing and make it easy and simple for people to figure out and pay off fines and fees? But again, I'm not a believer in fines and fees overall.
Yeah, I think my view on fines and fees is more complicated. It depends on what we're talking about. If you have and I don't know if this is one of the circumstances at issue here, if you have someone who's defrauded Bernie Madoff or someone else who's defrauded people out of $100,000 and there's a restitution order in place, and it's also shown that that person has assets and has not made any restitution, that to me is an open question. If you've really, paid the penalty that was imposed upon you by the judge. But then there are also all sorts of small bore assessments. There's a special assessment with respect to every count on which you're convicted in federal court. I believe it's still $100, which are sort of administrative costs, not the kind of penalty you're talking about that really relates to the conduct that you've engaged in. And if you are somebody who's impoverished and you go to prison and you have, a $400 assessment that you've not paid, and also you're not told that it's precisely $400, is it $300, is it $200, is it $400? That to me is very different. But there are circumstances in which, a financial penalty or restitution, I can see that being a good argument that you got to do that before, you're fully restored all your rights. By the way, did you see that Michael Bloomberg has promised $100 million to help elect Joe Biden in Florida? And the question that some people have asked, I don't know the answer to this. I don't know if you do. Will any of that money go towards this cause of paying back formerly incarcerated people's fees? Yeah.
So I think someone should push the state of Florida on this. Like, if Michael Bloomberg walked in and said, I'll pay the fines and fees, and the state of Florida can't give him the full amount, then the people should be able to vote, right? Because that would be, in my view, like an unacceptable sort of obstruction by the state if you can't sort of effectuate this because you can't know. Again, like, some of it just feels like a very unfair playing field if you can't find out what it is.
Yeah, it's like if you go to a restaurant and you order food and then you want to leave, it's like, well, you haven't paid your bill and you got to pay your full bill. Like, well, what is the bill? Like, well, how much did the food cost? Yeah.
And they say, I'm not going to tell you.
We're not sure. We're not sure. Yeah. And by the way, pay what you want and then leave. And if it turns out that you underpaid, we're going to come after you and the cops are going to arrest you. I mean, that's how ludicrous this situation is.
Yeah, and that's why I think somebody should test it and really basically say, oh, fine, okay, we'll pay it all. We'll pay it tomorrow. We want people to be registered to vote, that 1.4 million people. And my prediction is the state of Florida could not do it. And that, to me, makes this it's false, right? It's fake. If it's not possible to actually pay it off, then it's theoretical. You cannot stop people from voting based on that. And so this does feel to me like the wrong decision by the 11th Circuit for many reasons. And again, I think they're going on this idea that it's part of your sentence, so it's your responsibility, and they're not putting any responsibility on the government of Florida. And I think the government of Florida has to take responsibility on tracking this.
But the bottom line is, and I'll repeat again, the election is 49 days away. I think the likelihood of this being resolved in a way that allows lots of people who couldn't vote to be able to vote, unlikely to happen before the election.
I agree.
So before we go, Anne, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about this Bob Woodward book and the fact that there are tapes, Lordy, as a lot of people have mentioned. One question that arises, aside from what you feel about Donald Trump having played down and intentionally played down the seriousness of the coronavirus when he's behind the scenes telling Bob Woodward on tape.
I would say lie, but yes.
Yeah,
yes. It's five times, you know, worse and deadlier than the flu. It's airborne, et cetera. And there's more tapes that have been released in the last day showing that he said it's the plague. It's really horrible. That's not what he was saying in public. And there has been some criticism of Bob Woodward since he had those tapes way back in February and March that he didn't make them public sooner. And maybe that would have saved some people's lives. And, you know, whatever you think of Donald Trump, he does have some rhetorical cleverness about him, at least with respect to his base. And he's literally, when asked the question, I mean, do I think a sane person doesn't make any sense, but it has, I guess, some persuasive force. When asked, you know, why were you saying those things? And they put your public statements and your private statements, they're at odds with each other. Trump takes advantage of the fact that Woodward didn't release those statements for many months until the book came out to say, look, if Woodward thought they were so bad, he could have taken them to the authorities. The president of the United States says about someone else.
It's an absurd argument. Yeah, it's an absurd
argument. Taking them to the authorities.
Yes. Yeah.
What do you think about the criticism of Woodward?
So I had sort of three reactions to the tape. One, obviously, which I think a lot of people have you know, said very articulately, it's a horrible thing to see the president of the United States actively misleading and, I would argue, lying to the public and trying to undercut scientists when it's very clear that he did believe what the scientists were telling him. The second is that I found the president to be surprisingly lucid and in command of the facts in a way that, you know, when you see him, he isn't always, right? Like, it was a very interesting moment of, it's almost like a reverse Columbo thing. Like, publicly, he doesn't seem to be able to string three sentences together, and yet privately, you know, he seemed.
But he can do five words. He can remember five words in a row.
Yeah, but he seemed like he understands this, you know, more than sometimes you would think when you watched him. And so that makes it even worse in my view that he has a level of sort of basic understanding. But then when it comes to this, like, I think, you know, you and I both know a lot of folks who have books coming out right now, and their time to come out before the election, and the publishers decide when they come out to maximize book sales. And that's well and good for most things that are coming out where people are, you know, releasing statements. This feels different to me. This feels to me more like, you know, the analogy I would give you is whenever you run a randomized control trial where you're basically saying, okay, we're going to have a group, like, think about anything. You're testing, you know, you're testing a vaccine even, you know, one group gets the vaccine, one group doesn't. But as a rule, there are ethical requirements that the minute you see that some group is benefiting or being harmed significantly, like, you stop the test, right? Like, so, you know, if you've, like, you're morally obligated not to, like, if you can save lives, you do so, right? And this is a really important principle that, you know, as a rule, we don't let things go on when we have an obligation to one another and to protect and secure the safety of others. And so here,
it's hard to know if it would have changed. Like, to point out hypocrisy on the part of Trump, I mean, I agree with you totally, and I think he should have done more
with it. I think Trump's argument is terrible, and I don't think we should applaud that, but
the idea that pointing out hypocrisy on the part of Trump, that he's saying one thing in public and a different thing in private, that would have had some enormous, gigantic effect on public perception or on policy on the part of the administration or on the part of government. I mean, I don't know that is true. The president is a hypocrite single day.
The point is we don't know if it's true. And to the extent that, you know, the president was undercutting the scientists saying, like, you know, don't wear a mask, when he's also at the same time saying it's airborne, it's five times deadlier than the flu. Like, that feels to me like it could have also been relevant for people just to understand how to listen to the president's comments, because the president was aimed at election. So I don't know what the right standard is to hold Woodward to, but here's what I would have liked for him to have done, which is basically to have said to his publishers, because it does feel like the publishers determine the book schedule, and it's not a coincidence that his book is coming out a month before the election when it's poised to sell the most copies. I would have liked him to have basically said to them, the book has to come out right now. Like, I know we don't do it, but this is like important enough that either I need to release this or we up the date of the book release. And again, I want to be fair to him. I think he's a great journalist. I think it's an amazing thing that the president of the United States is just willing to talk to him on and on.
And by the way, has not really attacked him in the way that you would expect and the way he's attacked other people. I think he actually does respect the guy. Look, I should point out also on this issue of the president being hypocritical on mixed messages about the coronavirus, it's happening at this moment, right? The official policy put out by his doctors and Fauci, and he's actually echoed this from time to time and actually worn a mask and was happy that people said he looked badass in a mask. He said, don't have a problem with a mask. And when pressed by the media, he has said, masks, people should wear masks because he has no choice but to say that. At the same time, he's retweeting accounts that are talking about no masks and protesting masks. So he himself, at the same time, some months ago, he's talking about how, there should be some shutting down of public events when it made sense for him to talk about it that way and in front of the national media. My recollection is at the same time, he's sending out tweets like Free Michigan. So he's all over the map on all of this stuff all the time. That's the only point I'm making.
No, I think that's right. And look, I want to be fair to Bob Woodward. I just didn't love that piece of it. But I also think, look, it's really important that he's written it. It's also really important that he released the tapes because, he obviously knew the president would undercut whatever he said. And the proof is there. And it's clearly the president of the United States talking. And, I was waiting for the president to say, it's not me.
And it makes for effective Biden. It makes for effective Joe Biden ads also.
Definitely. So Preet, before we leave today, just a moment to talk about something really tragic and distressing that happened in Los Angeles 2 days ago, where two sheriff's deputies were shot, ambushed essentially by a gunman. They were both shot multiple times. We know one was a 31-year-old female sheriff's deputy. The other was a 24-year-old man. They both just graduated from the academy about 14 months ago, so fairly new on the job. Both, we think, it's been reported, at least so far, targeted as police officers, as law enforcement. We don't know more. The suspect is still at large, but I think it's really important just to note that as we've talked a lot about police misconduct in our country and use of force and sort of had probing questions about what the right use of force is and talking about racial justice and equity, it's also really important to note how important it is to have law enforcement in our communities and how, it's just devastating to see this. And particularly if it's true that they were targeted because they're men and women who have essentially devoted their lives to serving the public, that would be beyond tragic.
Yeah, I've seen a surveillance video of that shooting, which is very disturbing and distressing to watch. Essentially, a gunman happens upon their car, very intentionally levels off and fires shots, and then scurries off. That person is still at large. I hope and pray that that person is found and held fully accountable. The good news is that it looks like at least the woman is in stable condition. I'm not sure what the condition of the young man is. Hopefully they'll survive and be well. It reminds me, I don't know if you remember this, a few years ago, there were two NYPD officers who were similarly ambushed, shot in the head, and they both were essentially killed, execution style. And, that should never happen. And debates that we engage in with respect to policing and reform and all of that are important, and peaceful protest is important. But everyone should condemn violence of this kind against police officers because it's a dangerous job.
I agree. Look, it's also happened in Camden. I can't remember if it was a year or two ago, but there was an officer that was shot similarly to New York. And again, it is among the most dangerous jobs and in my view, one of the most important jobs in society. And so I think, we have to both be able to be reflective on how we police, self-reflective, and ask questions of whether we're doing it as well as we possibly can, but also really honor and respect. And of course, I agree with you. I hope that the individual is apprehended and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
So, Anne, on that sad note, that's it for this week. Next week, it'll be 42 days from the election. Be well. I'll talk to you then.
And please send us your questions to letters@cafe.com. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon, Preet.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Sam Ozer-Staden, David Kurlander, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.